Good afternoon. My name is Ann Cavall, and on behalf of the Breast Cancer Education Association Board and Volunteers, I welcome you to the BCEA webinar series. I encourage you to grab a pen and paper, as there will be plenty of good information shared in the next hour. Today, we have participants joining us in two ways, via webcast or by phone. For those connected via webcast, please follow along with the slideshow on your screen. Webcast attendees can also submit questions at any time during the session in the box just to the left of the slides. The BCEA continues to expand our mission of providing breast cancer education resources. This year's education programming continues to encourage, engage, and empower those affected by breast cancer in a variety of ways, including webinars such as this one offered throughout the year. Also, participation in and support of culturally appropriate cancer screening, education, and outreach programs to reduce disparities in the burden of cancer. Last year, we offered three mini conferences focused on reducing disparities and offering resources and education, and we hope and are working to continue these efforts in 2020. We also deliver critical breast health information through our signature education conference held each October. This conference delivers the most up-to-date information on breast cancer diagnosis, treatments, and survivorship, and features a mobile mammography unit. Please mark your calendar for October 3rd, 2020 at the Wilder Center in St. Paul, and we hope to see you there. And finally, we offer information resources through increased ongoing resources on our website and social media channels that are available 24/7. If you were unable to attend any of our previous webinars, recordings of these sessions are available on the BCEA website at www.breastcancereducation.org under the webinars tab. This is a great way to easily access valuable information at your convenience. The BCEA also welcomes your involvement in our organization. We welcome participation on all levels and have many different types of volunteer opportunities available, whether it is just for an hour a year or a couple hours a month. We have exciting plans this year and hope that you can help us deliver education and empowerment to those fighting breast cancer. Please be sure to also keep your eye out for more information on our upcoming webinars. We will share specific information on all sessions as soon as details are available. And now I'd like to introduce our featured speaker for today's webinar, Dr. Andrew Mayo. A native of Minnesota, Dr. Mayo was inspired to pursue a career in medicine by his family's long history of dedication to community health care and innovation. After completing his family practice residency at Bethesda Hospital in St. Paul, Dr. Mayo spent 17 years practicing in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin, with an emphasis in geriatrics. Dr. Mayo has served on clinical and hospital leadership boards and as medical director for Luck United Pioneer Home and Frederick Nursing and Rehabilitation Community. In 2014, Dr. Mayo joined St. Croix Hospice as an associate medical director, where he is now chief medical officer. Dr. Mayo received his undergraduate degree from St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, and went on to study medicine at the University of Minnesota. He continues to pursue additional medical training and has hospice medical director certification. Welcome, Dr. Mayo.
Well, thank you very much, Anne, and it's a privilege to be able to present here today, and thank you to the Breast Cancer Education Association for allowing me to share my story. I certainly hope that I'm able to encourage, engage, and empower the listeners today. So thank you very much. So today I'd like to share my story of why hospice is such a passion for me. And in this, we'll talk about the importance of a person's story, and we'll build awareness of the basic concept of hospice and the interdisciplinary team concept that I believe is very important in medicine. And the awareness, we'll talk about the awareness of multiple roles as a hospice physician. Understand the concept of the dichotomy of love and grief. And we'll talk about something at the end, what I call the Moss effect. And it's basically related to the importance of mindfulness. So I'd like to start my talks with this quote. You matter because of who you are. You matter to the last moment of your life. And we will do all we can, not only to help you die peacefully, but also to live until you die. That is the mantra of hospice, and that was from Dame Cicely Saunders, who's considered the originator of modern hospice. And I think this is such an important quote because the word hospice can bring up such fear for people, but it really clearly talks about living and the importance of living the best life you can with the time that you have remaining. And I think this is an important quote for everybody, no matter what stage in life we are, focusing on living life as best we can. So in sharing my story, I think stories are very important to how we receive healthcare. A patient's story provides meaning, context, and an understanding of a patient's experience of illness. In other words, their narrative builds the bridge connecting the evidence of large clinical trials to the individual patient. You know, unless we know how a patient has come to be where they are, how they have received their medical information, their experiences in their life, shapes how they are able to receive the cares that we can render to them. And in many cases, understanding that affects the decisions that we may make in delivering healthcare. So I'm going to talk today about my story, how I came into hospice. Well, first, as many of us were, I believe most people listening today were born at one point in time, and as was I. So there I am as a happy baby, born in Minnesota. But I was born to a physician, Dr. Charles H. Mayo II. There, he and I are sitting at the steps of the Mayo Clinic. My father was a physician, trained as a surgeon, but worked in primary care a majority of his life. And he was born to a physician. That's my grandfather, Dr. Charles W. Mayo, also born in Minnesota and practiced at the Mayo Clinic. And he was born to a physician. That's my great-grandfather, Dr. Charles H. Mayo. And he was born to a physician. Dr. William Worrell Mayo was Dr. Charles H. Mayo's father. He was also known as the Little Doctor, and he was in Le Sueur, Minnesota. He was quite a pioneering physician, started out working as a pharmacist, also pursued a career in textiles. He was a tailor. And also did quite a bit of exploring of the state of Minnesota. His house was in Le Sueur, Minnesota. And even though the Mayo brothers are typically considered the founders of the Mayo Clinic, he himself thought he was the inspiration behind the Mayo Clinic. But I do think he was a pioneer as well. I think he was also one of the original hipsters. There he is seated with his family, his wife, Louise, and sporting a nice hipster beard. But the Mayo brothers certainly are considered the founders of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. There's the Mayo Clinic building, the original 1950s building. My grandfather participated in many different areas of medicine. He was a surgeon. He worked for the United Nations and also was involved in military. So when we talk about the Mayo Clinic, what really made the Mayo Clinic great was not necessarily that they were excellent surgeons. They were fine surgeons, but the Mayo brothers recognized that it takes a multidisciplinary team to provide care, and they were the first multi-specialty group in the world, and that's really what Mayo Clinic's claim to fame is the first multi-specialty group practice. And I think that that is an important part of my heritage. Certainly medicine has been a family tradition. I myself was inspired by my father to go into family practice. When I was little, he would bring me into the exam rooms and show me different illnesses and just the interactions with his patients. And what I found is the importance of the connection with who you are treating. And I think that's something that we need to be very aware of in this day and age, where a computer is often another member in the room, and it can lead to a focus on facts, which is certainly appropriate, but also it can lose a person's story. And a person's story is very important to where they have come to be. So I myself went into family medicine. I practiced in St. Croix Falls. I delivered babies. I was part of the emergency room. I admitted patients and cared for patients in the hospital. I did clinic work and also worked at nursing homes as medical director and rounding physician. And then I was asked to help in hospice. I started out in around 2012 as an associate medical director. And during that time, I was struck by hospice and its approach to care for a patient. They truly embraced the team approach and delivered excellent care. So who is part of the hospice team? Well, the team consists of a medical director or attending physician, the RN case manager, a hospice aide, a social worker, spiritual care, and also there's therapists that can be involved, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, music therapy, massage therapy, pet therapy, and even dietary counselors. All these people approaching the patient from their own specialty. And so I started really developing an appreciation for the correlation to what the Mayo Clinic did in their multi-specialty approach to care and what hospice does for a patient. You know, as a patient's physical condition starts to dwindle, their spiritual and their social being needs every bit as much attention as their physical being. And by having a team like a hospice team that can address those issues from different points of view, I think is what sets that type of care apart. So the history of hospice. Hospice comes from an ancient term back in medieval times when it referred to a place of shelter, a place of rest for the weary or ill travelers on a long journey, and was first applied by Dame Cicely Saunders in 1967, who founded the first modern hospice in a suburb of London. That was St. Christopher's Hospice. A physician must certify that an individual's prognosis is that of 6 months or less to be eligible for hospice. many people think that it's complicated, but really it takes just a physician stating that a patient has 6 months or less to live. Now, there is complications to it. Certainly, Medicare provides what we call LCDs, which are local coverage determinations that outline what a person for hospice should qualify like. Some diagnoses, certainly everyone recognizes cancer as a qualifying diagnosis, but other diagnoses include heart disease, pulmonary disease, ALS, and Parkinson's disease, just to name a few. Other indicators include liver disease, kidney disease, renal failure, Alzheimer's disease, cerebral vascular accidents, HIV, other types of dementia or neuroprogressive diseases. The services provided by hospice include education for the patient and family on the dying process, family decision making, helping in quality of life and hope, and bereavement. Also, to promote and collaboration and customization with families and facilities. So to this point, hospice, like the Mayo Clinic, has achieved excellence in caring for people based on a multidisciplinary approach to the care of a person. The team approach to care is also exemplified in hospice. So to this point, my hospice story really consisted of what is a patient's story and what is important to that patient. That it's okay to strive for cure, but we have to also recognize when it's time to take a step back. And in doing so, we need to understand what a patient's goals are for the remaining time that they have. And the question I ask is, are we doing a good enough job in informing patients? There's a great book by Atul Gawande called Being Mortal. And in that book, he talked about five questions that we should be asking patients, and really we should be asking ourselves and family members. The first question was, what is your understanding of your illness and where you are in its course? So many times I've run into patients who don't even realize that they have end-stage congestive heart failure or end-stage chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and don't understand where they are in that journey. The second question is, what are your fears and worries for your future? What are you worried about happening with the disease process that you have going on? And the third question is, what are your goals and priorities? What's important to you in the time that you have remaining? And then the fourth question is, what outcomes are unacceptable to you, given the potential of treatments causing harm as well as a potential for cure? What are the outcomes that those treatments may bring on that are unacceptable? What are the outcomes of the disease process that you're worried about and are also unacceptable? And then finally, what does a good day look like? You know, what is it that would achieve a good day for you given the disease process that you're experiencing? And sometimes that may be for a person to be able to be at home, to be able to be involved with family versus being in a hospital. And so for each person, you know, what does a good day look like is an individual thing. But unless we know their story and where they've come from and what's important to them, it's difficult to make a decision on treatment unless we know the answers to some of these questions. So my great-grandfather's brother, William, said, the best interest of the patient is the only interest to be considered. So I ask, what does this mean in light of our technological abilities? There are many things that we are able to do that in treatments that may not necessarily be in the patient's best interest. So the fact that we can do something doesn't necessarily mean that we should do something. So when is more not necessarily in the best interest of the patient? I think that this is a very different, or this is a very difficult question today in light of the medical treatments that we have available to us. So oftentimes, once we start going down a certain pathway, it's very difficult sometimes, as a physician even, to take a step back and to say, is more treatment really in the best interest of this patient? And again, this is where the story and understanding a person is important to making those decisions. So here's a fellow, rapid pulse, sweating, shallow breathing. According to the computer, you've got gallstones. And this is just an example of where a person's story might become very important. You know, I was walking through the woods during hunting season and I felt a sharp pain in my back. So it's probably not gallstones. So that's where technology and facts and data is wonderful. But oftentimes a story will trump that data. And even developing a relationship, a deeper understanding of who that person is, even can trump a story. So one of the areas that people often get confused about is the question between palliative care and hospice care. And palliative care is something that we probably all engage at some point in time. Even taking a Tylenol is palliative care. It takes care of a headache. It doesn't treat necessarily the underlying cause of the headache, but it will alleviate a headache. So palliative care is care that's focused on taking care of symptoms. It's not focused on curing an underlying disease. Hospice care is basically palliative care, but it's palliative care that takes place in the last 6 months of life. And so hospice is currently a program, largely a Medicare program, though many individual private insurances also have a hospice benefit. But hospice care is for patients who have been determined to have a life expectancy of 6 months or less, and that the focus is on palliating symptoms rather than curing the underlying disease. So on the bottom of this slide is a graphic that shows kind of the progress of how one deals with any underlying medical condition. So on the onset of a chronic disease, we're focused on modifying that course of disease. So largely, the treatment is curative. We will certainly prescribe medications and therapies and things that will take care of their symptoms as well, but the main focus is on curing. But as time goes on, more and more of that treatment becomes more palliative in nature. For instance, in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, we'll be focusing on trying to make that person more comfortable in terms of their breathing. While the medicines may not necessarily alter the underlying lung disease, it will help to treat the pulmonary disease. And once that disease has gotten to a point where a physician believes that they have less than 6 months or less to live, that's when they would qualify for hospice, and that palliative treatment would be covered under the hospice benefit. And then for hospice, after a person dies, there's also a 12 to 13 month period of bereavement where the family members and loved ones can receive bereavement care after a loved one's death.
I just want to take this opportunity to remind our participants that they may submit questions. Those that have joined via webcast can simply enter their questions right to the left of the slides on the screen.
Thank you. So I like to view serious illness as an airplane. Palliative care and hospice can actually help people. And sometimes hospice actually helps people live longer, though that's not the intent of hospice. And some of the misconceptions are comfort medicines do not hasten death. So when you view serious illness as an airplane, hospice and palliative medicine can really help provide more of a gentle landing versus a more abrupt crash. So many people are at a stage in their disease process where they're faced with trying to make decisions. You know, should I focus on the illness and specific treatments and be aggressive, or should I focus comfort and palliation, or take a different road down the middle? And again, this goes back to understanding a patient's story and where they are in their journey in trying to help and guide patients into making the right decision for them. None of these decisions are the wrong decision, but so often patients don't realize that they have a choice. There's been studies that have shown aggressive care at the end of life can produce unintended effects. For patients, there's greater physical and psychological distress, and actually, in many cases, there's lower reported overall quality of life. For the caregivers who are witnessing and helping those patients, that are seeking aggressive care, the caregivers have more major depression and an overall lower perceived satisfaction of the care that they've received. These are just a couple of studies that I've placed in here. The first study looks at cases of poor prognosis cancer and the effect of being involved in hospice actually saved Medicare over $12,000. The other study looks at sort of hospice involved in general and saving Medicare system anywhere from $2,300 to $2,500 per patient. Now, when we talk about the effect on people's lives, this kind of speaks to what I talk about as the Zen of hospice. When we start to focus on quality of life and palliation of symptoms versus looking at aggressive care, recent studies have shown that it can actually result in people living longer. For instance, people who were involved in hospice who had congestive heart failure averaged 81 days longer than those patients just seeking aggressive care alone. And the same is for these other diseases: lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, all had an increased length of life when they weren't even focusing on that as a goal. They were focusing on living life the best possible with the time that they had remaining with hospice care. That's pretty remarkable. So we were talking a little bit about the cost of aggressive care, and here this fellow is talking to his doctor. It's just a simple little operation, but we want you to pay now. So up to this point in my life and my career, that concept of hospice being a multidisciplinary approach and its correlation to my heritage of the Mayo Clinic was a big part of my story. And pictured here is my wife. She was very instrumental in pushing me into hospice. When I was first approached by Heath Bartness and St. Croix Hospice and offered a position as chief medical officer, my wife told me, she said, "Andy, you love hospice. When you come home from being at hospice, your cup is full. You have to do this." So she really encouraged me to take that step and leave a full-time practice that I was perfectly happy in and to pursue hospice as a full-time career. On March 2nd, 2016, my family and I went up to North House, which is a folk school up in Grand Marais, Minnesota. My father, in his retirement from medicine, had gone into birch bark basket weaving. And if you ever have a chance to make it up to North House for a class, it's a wonderful place to go. Beautiful on the north shore of Lake Superior. There's my father teaching my daughter how to weave birch bark. There's one of the baskets that we're making. My wife that day had the flu, so we thought, and she decided to stay back at the hotel that we were staying at. When we got home from Grand Marais, she still wasn't feeling well, and she went to the urgent care, and we found out that her platelet count was 13,000, and I knew something was not right. So I drove and picked her up, and we went to the Mayo Clinic and went straight into the emergency room there. And their doctor came in to the room and told us that she didn't have the flu. She had acute myeloid leukemia. And she was promptly admitted into the Methodist Hospital at Mayo Clinic, Rochester. And we started talking about chemotherapy. And there I was, a hospice physician, a classically trained physician, a father, and a husband presented with this situation, a situation in which I desperately wanted to cure my wife. I also wanted to be able to comfort my family and to maintain hope. But I also wanted to not harm my wife because I knew the potential side effects of these medications. And while I had an understanding of the reality of her prognosis, she had a less than 19% chance of 5-year survival. And so I was torn between being a physician who wanted to cure her, a father who wanted to present hope to his children and to his wife, and also as a hospice physician to do no harm and to try to ensure that she has a quality of life with the time that she would have remaining. Well, she was a trooper. She underwent her first round of chemotherapy and actually did pretty well. She was a fighter. Unfortunately, the first round of chemotherapy wasn't particularly effective, and we were told that she'd have to go under a second round of chemotherapy. With the second round of chemotherapy, it took her heart from an ejection fraction of 55% down to 13%. It affected her liver and she became jaundiced. It affected her lungs to the point where she was sent to the ICU on 3 separate occasions and was intubated and on a respirator for those three separate occasions. But ultimately, at that time, after that second round and living through the three ICU stays, she went into remission. We went back after her last bone marrow biopsy to get the results, and we went into, after 3 months of being in the hospital, we went into the clinic to talk with her doctor and found out that even after the second round of chemotherapy, her cancer had returned. It was at that point that my wife turned to me and she said, "Andy, I have 15 minutes left in this world. I want to go home. I want to see our daughter graduate from high school. I want to be with the people that I love. I want to be on hospice." And that's when St. Croix Hospice came directly into my life and provided care for my wife and my family. She was able to be at home with our daughters. She was able to see my daughter graduate from high school. She was able to be surrounded by the people that she loved. Hospice allowed me to be a husband and a father. It allowed my wife to be at home where she was most comfortable, and allowed my wife to be surrounded by those she loved the most to the very end. And she was surrounded by 16 people at the time that she passed away who loved her very, very much. She passed away on October 23rd, on June 7th, 2016. So one of the things that I didn't talk about on the other slide was bereavement, and it's often overlooked in hospice when we talk about hospice, but every month I got a call from the chaplain who said, "Andy, how are you doing? How's your family doing? How can we help?" And just having somebody checking in was just an incredible experience and very, very helpful. Bereavement is one of the unsung heroes of what hospice can provide. So having gone through this experience, there's some considerations I'd like to bring up. How do we approach end-of-life issues in a medicalized society? So often it's quantity over quality. But I think that's something that we need to reflect upon when we think about our own lives and the health care that each of us want to receive. How is hospice part of the continuum of care? So often, hospice isn't even brought up, and people don't even realize what hospice can do and that they are potentially eligible to receive hospice care. And I've gone into situations where I've talked with physicians who, when I ask them about their experience with hospice, they say, "I don't refer people to hospice because every time I refer a patient to hospice, they die." And while that may sound kind of silly, what happens is that those experiences are often the result of referring patients to hospice when it's at the very end, when they're already actively dying. Hospice is a six-month benefit, and to be able to recognize and to be able to have a conversation with a patient and letting them know that this is an option if it's right for them would alleviate a lot of that type of experience. So that's one of the misconceptions of hospice, is that it's a place to go to die. And really, in my mind, it's a place to go to live the best life that one can with shorter life expectancy. What are some of the benefits of hospice care for patients and caregivers? And again, that multidisciplinary approach to care, the benefit of bereavement, and the ability to focus on palliative care and living the best day possible. And in retrospect, what are the missed opportunities for hospice? When I look back at my career as a family physician, I recognize that there's those situations where I didn't take a step back. And it began to formulate a question, what if hospice was a pill? If I was able to say, Mr. Jones, you have congestive heart failure, and how do you feel about having been into the hospital these last three times or this last 1 month? You've been in the emergency room three times. If I could tell you I could write a pill, write a prescription for a pill that would allow you to stay at home, it would take care of your shortness of breath, it would take care of your pain, and you would never have to go into the hospital again, would that be a pill that you'd like me to write for you? And I believe the answer would be, yeah, doc, write me that pill. I don't want to go back to the hospital. Well, that pill is hospice. If hospice was a pill, it would be a multi-billion dollar drug. It would probably be one of the most common prescribed pills there is, just because of what it can do and the power it has to palliate symptoms. I'm not sure what these are, but take them for a couple of weeks and let me know how you feel. So in this experience, I've gained, I believe, some life observations that I hope will be helpful to you. That as we go through life, the little things that we do can impact others without you even knowing it. When I was in the hospital, when my wife was in the hospital, I was staying in the hospital with her for those 3 months. One day a nurse took me aside and said, Dr. Mayo, you've been in here every day. How are you doing? And I was doing as well as I could, but just having somebody ask that had a great impact on my well-being. And so it's made me aware of how I conduct myself and realizing that the little things, a smile, a hug, a handshake, a word of acknowledgement that we may even do just in passing can have a tremendous impact on somebody's day and on somebody's life. The other thing that I've learned is being open to the acceptance of the gift of help, the gift of counseling. Is an important thing to sometimes let pride aside and to accept the help of others. Happiness versus joy. Joy is, I wish I had an answer to how you achieve joy, but joy is something that we hold inside of ourselves. It springs from our inner being. Happiness is like bubbles in champagne. It's fleeting. It's wonderful at the time, but it's fleeting. But it can exist with underlying joy. But underlying joy allows us to experience grief, sadness, anger, and happiness, but yet still be joyful on the inside. And I think some of the experiences of recognizing the preciousness of life and being appreciative of those is one of the ways to start heading towards joy. And when we look at life in general, so often it's the little things in life are what is important. Sometimes we plan big trips and we plan great momentous occasions, but oftentimes it's the experience that we live breath by breath that are often impactful and memorable. When my wife was in the hospital, I was helping her from the commode back to the bed. She was very weak. And in that moment, we just stood there and embraced each other in an understanding of just being in love. And that moment will live with me forever, and it's a precious moment that was just in the middle of being transferred from a commode to a bed. But those are the things that happen in life that we need to appreciate and to be aware of. What I've learned about grief is that grief and love are two sides of the same coin. They are what I call a symbiotic dichotomy. Without one, the other does not exist. So in this, the grief I have every day that will never leave me is tempered by the knowledge and the fact that I know that grief stems from great love. And on the other side of that, when one loves and allows themselves to love, it opens them up for the potential of grief. And so that's where love and grief are two sides of the same coin. And I think in my grief, at least for me, allowing myself to continue to love tempers by an understanding that love is joined to grief. So on the day my wife passed away, I walked into the kitchen, and there was a white moth, and this was before she passed away. There was a white moth, and the first words out of my mouth of this moth flittering about the kitchen, I said, "Oh, look, there's Marin." That was my wife's name. And I caught that moth in my hands, and I walked it outside, and I let that moth go, and it flew up. It circled back, and it landed on my hand. And it just sat there, flapping its wings slowly. And I let that moth go again, and it flew up, and it flew up into the trees. About a week later, I was listening to a radio show, and they were talking about mythology, and there was a talking about white butterflies and white moths as a soul in transition, and it brought me right back to that moment I had with this moth, and what that really speaks to me is that there are things that occur in our lives every day that we may or may not notice. But when we do notice and we're mindful of the things going on around us that can impact us, that it can bring great meaning to our lives. And so being aware of those little things in life that bring meaning to life is very important. This is a quote from Siddhartha. "They both listened silently to the water, which to them was not just water, but the voice of life, the voice of being, the voice of perpetual becoming." And for me, that means having a great faith and understanding that my life is being directed and that current of the river is going to take me to where I need to be. How we approach death, dying, and love and grief is one of the most important factors in the line of human endeavor. I greatly believe that. So that's my wife on the right, and that was her best friend who walked beside me after my wife passed away. And I'm happy to say we were married a little over a year ago. And love is a wonderful thing. So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions that people may have. And thank you.
First of all, we want to thank you for such a personal and touching story. We really appreciate you sharing that with us, and it is such important information that we learned today. We do have a few questions that that I would love to ask you. The first one goes back to the earlier presentation, and it was about data. And so the data is surprising that even one day on hospice seems to prolong life in a hospice patient. Can you elaborate on the reasons of why hospice imparts that survival benefit?
Yeah, you know, I think, again, that's the Zen. Part of it is the Zen of hospice. So when we start to focus on quality of life and we start to bring people into a person's home or into the nursing home that they're at, into an assisted living that they're at, that additional care and that additional focus that's all focused on their well-being, I think has a deep effect on a person's quality of life. And when we feel that our quality of life is improved, I think that has a very physical impact on affecting disease course. And so I think that's one of the main things. The other thing that we often do in hospice is de-prescribe medications. I mean, people coming onto hospice are often on 20, 30 drugs. And we know that when we get beyond 5 medications, the interactions are so significant potentially amongst these different medications that simply by getting rid of some of the medications can have a big impact on a person's quality of life and also maybe some of the side effects that these medications are bringing into their lives and affecting, you know, their longevity ultimately.
Another question that we got was, do you encounter resistance from providers to refer their patients to hospice? I think you referenced one already in your presentation. And if so, when you encounter this resistance, why do you think that may be?
Well, the training that I got in medical school and residency really for hospice and end-of-life care was zero. And so in medicine as physicians, we're, you know, taught that death is the enemy and that we are to stomp out disease. And so we get going down a trajectory of treating a disease, and when one treatment doesn't work, we move on to the next treatment. And oftentimes, unfortunately, it's at the expense of the well-being of the patient. And it's that ability to recognize when is it time to take a step back. And also, it's also the lack of engagement of understanding a person's story and understanding what's important to a person. If people knew that they had an option, in some cases, not to do more, it's a choice that they would make, but that conversation is not taking place. And as physicians, we get so invested in seeking a cure that we don't provide that opportunity for the conversation for an alternative way to approach life and the end of life.
And so how can we support those conversations more about hospice and its benefits?
Oh, well, so I think that, you know, one, raising awareness of, you know, those five questions. I think for us as individuals with family members who may have illness, talking with them about, you know, what is important to you with the time that you have remaining. If you have a chronic illness, do you know what the doctor's prognosis is for that disease? And do you know what you want and how you want to live if you have a limited amount of time remaining? And I think what we can do is be ask the question that the physicians aren't asking. Certainly, I think they have made moves in the medical education to start to involve end-of-life care discussions, but still we have a long way to go. So unfortunately, I think many of these conversations have to start from a grassroots level. If there are nurses on the call, I think, you know, having that conversation with patients, family members, having that conversation, and even with ourselves, having that conversation of how do we want to receive care and what is important to each and every one of us. I think that's something we should all be reflecting on.
Just working off of that, we did get a question from a participant that also was specifically, how do you explain to people that you don't want to be at home at the time of death and that you would actually prefer to be in a facility? Do you have any tips or advice on that?
I think it, and who was the question from?
It was from a woman, Nancy, who is a participant on the webinar right now.
Yeah, you know, I think it also, you know, that it comes down to, you know, being comfortable and one, understanding, you know, what are the motivators as to why you want to be in one place or another place or don't want to be in one place or another place, understanding that, understanding, you know, what are the resources available for, you know, and what type of care could I receive being in home, and what cares could I receive being somewhere else? And then I think bringing up that conversation comes down to, one, knowing what you want for yourself, and then just being able to express that to somebody. But I think it takes that reflection to understand what are your concerns and to be able to relay those concerns and what are your desires and why. And I think that, and then it just takes being open and honest to have that conversation.
Well, gracious thanks to our speaker, Dr. Mayo, and to everyone for joining us today. Again, please share what you learned today via our social media channels, and we look forward to seeing you on another BCEA webinar. Thank you.